On June 18th, at a strip mall in a small town in the far upstate of South Carolina, Homeland Security investigations arrested 8 people on immigration charges and 2 people on disorderly conduct charges at Puerto Nuevo, a popular Mexican restaurant. While this was going on, a crowd gathered in the parking lot to watch. It was all over the news in West Union, where the incident took place, and across Oconee County. West Union is a small town. It's between Clemson and Walhalla, close to Lake Kiawee and the Georgia state line. When I say it's a small town, I mean that people talk. Word spread quickly about what had happened. Shortly afterward, we got a voice message from John Aguilar. He had some thoughts.
As far as the situation with the raid and stuff at Puerto and stuff, I'm more disappointed in my community at the negativity and everything I've seen. That, like, I've grown up with some of these people. And, you know, I've been to their houses, I've been to their birthday parties, I've been to, you know, all sorts of stuff with them. They've been to stuff for me. They've supported me. They've congratulated me when I've gotten, you know, different jobs or different whatever. And that's what hurts me the most, is seeing that. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, you look at me, you know, I'm Mexican, I'm Hispanic. It just hurts me to see this stuff going on and seeing these people that my whole life, you know, we're Christian, we go to church, you know, treat everybody as like you would be treated. Because that's one thing here hello, Coney. You can't go anywhere and talk to anybody without being, the question you get asked is, have you been saved? You know, I would hear that all the time. Growing up Catholic, we didn't ask that, we didn't do that. But anytime I went to vacation Bible school, to a French church on a Sunday or whatever it was, that was the first question. Have you been saved? And seeing the people that were asking these questions or at these services, not just making fun of these, you know, immigrants that are, you know, yeah, they're not here illegally, but those guys, they were here to work. They were here to provide. They were here to help their families better themselves. You know, that's what hurts me the most, is seeing my community turn its back on the people that have been here for years, that have been, you know, hell feeding them. You could go to Puerto on, you know, any given night, and that place would be packed out. Birthday parties, this, all stuff going out, and now you have all these people just being nasty, these, you know, quote-unquote Christians, and it's just being nasty. And that's one of the things that I really just do not understand, is how this community, this area, can just quickly turn its back, because I feel like they've been fed a bunch of lies and a bunch of stuff. And they look at all the, you know, all the folks that are here legally, and hell, even if they are, I mean, I've been approached at plenty of places, and the first question I'm asked is, oh yeah, where are you from? I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm not from anywhere. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm an American. I was a cop. I was in the Marine Corps Reserves. You know, I've done stuff for my community, for my country and things. And you have people that have done nothing but criticize and, you know, talk shit, putting themselves above people that have done more than them for everything. And then, you know, one thing I would always hear is like, oh, that guy's so good, he'd give you the shirt off his back, he'd do this, he'd do that, or he would do anything for his kids, anything for his family. But then you see people really doing anything for their family, really putting in the work, really sacrificing for their family, for their kids, for their wives, and all you catch is these holier-than-thou Christians saying, you know, they're criminals, they're all drug dealers, they're all this, get them out, kick them out, deport them, put them in alligator Alcatraz, feed them to the gators. I mean, that's insane to me.
Welcome to episode 15 of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Jace Woodrum.
And I'm your other host, Paul Bowers. Today's episode is going to be about immigration enforcement and the way it has changed our state in the year 2025 so far. I know this is top of mind for a lot of our listeners already, but I wanted to read a few headlines from around the state just to give an idea of where we are right now. This is from July 31st on ABC News 4 in Charleston. Traumatizing. Security camera captures ICE detainment at North Charleston home. February 3rd, NBC News. Men in 2 states are accused of impersonating ICE officers. A man in South Carolina told a Latino man he would be sent back to Mexico. August 22nd, Live 5 News. Charleston County schools report low attendance among multilingual students. Associate Superintendent of School Support, Dr. Shivana Coakley, says there is a fear factor among students returning to school because of the current political climate. Now, we're going to speak to some people today who have felt the consequences of the shift in immigration enforcement this year. But I wanted to open up first just by talking about what you've seen and heard this year, Jace. What concerns are you hearing, and how is immigration enforcement different in our state than it was in 2024?
Paul, there is so much happening at the federal level. As much as I want to, you know, keep our focus here in South Carolina, we can't ignore, you know, everything that's happening nationally. I mean, we've got, you know, shutting down asylum just as an option, period. Denying due process to any immigrant who has been here for less than 2 years. Trying to end birthright citizenship. I mean, it's day after day, another attack on immigrant communities. I know for me, I'm so grateful for our ACLU colleagues just around the country who are taking the administration to court for these blatantly unconstitutional policies and practices. It's, you know, because of their work that we at the ACLU of South Carolina are able to focus right here at home. And I'll tell you, it's a pretty grim story. You know, I'm hearing from immigrants, both documented and undocumented folks, people who don't know how they might be targeted by this administration. You know, folks who are here legally, and yet they don't know when the focus of this administration will turn to them. So the impacts are really felt every day. I've heard about kids being kept home from school, families putting off medical care or skipping church on Sunday. And that's because one of the first things the Trump administration did was allow immigration enforcement to happen anywhere. Even when folks show up at immigration court for their hearing with an immigration judge. I mean, there are just no rules about where we can arrest people. And of course, we're hearing so many stories about where folks are being detained and how unsafe those conditions are, how folks are being taken far from their families and communities, often being denied access to their attorneys. And I want to make this clear. This is also impacting folks who aren't immigrants. You know, folks like me, I'm not an immigrant, but I feel the impacts. I mean, I worry about neighbors, colleagues, friends. I don't trust law enforcement when I see them in my community anymore. You know, I read these stories, these headlines about folks being arrested by masked officers and not wearing, you know, name tags and badges, you know, people being picked up walking home after religious service because of, you know, their exercise of their free speech rights. I mean, the public safety of all of us is impacted. And there's this feeling of fear that just, I feel, is weighing down certainly immigrant communities and those who love them, but it's touching all of us.
We're going to talk a lot on this episode about what's new this year, but I want to be clear that the status quo on immigration in this country and on the policies and enforcement that our country has had was bad to begin with. You know, the Obama and Biden administrations also carried out brutal border enforcement. They maintained an inhumane immigration system and made pathways to citizenship difficult to impossible for a lot of people. And there are important, you know, degrees of change, and there are important distinctions from one administration to the next. But, you know, the status quo was never good here, and it's just getting worse. One notable change, though, that we've seen this year is the shift to more openly hostile immigration policy. Often, this is being pushed by a senior White House advisor who you may have heard of named Stephen Miller. So famously in May, Stephen Miller went on Fox News and said,
"We are looking to set a goal of a minimum of 3,000 arrests for ICE every day. And President Trump is going to keep pushing to get that number up higher each and every single day."
And there's been some sort of waffling and hedging about that exact number. But as we look at the way ICE agents and their collaborators operate around the country, they do still prioritize deportation numbers rather than public safety. And that means that they are emphatically not going after cartel members or murderers for the most part. Instead, they are seeking to deport people en masse who often have only committed a civil or misdemeanor offense related to their immigration status. So we're going to talk about two federal agencies a lot today. A department and an agency. The Department of Homeland Security was created in 2003 in response to the September 11th attacks, and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was also founded in 2003 as a law enforcement agency under DHS. Showing my age here, I am older than both of these agencies. They've not been around that long. They don't have to be here forever. ICE in particular has been notorious this year for sending agents into the field, as you mentioned, Jace, with their faces and badges covered, refusing to show warrants, refusing to release any sort of paperwork about their arrests or the names of the people they've arrested in many cases. And they arrest people in a way that is sometimes indistinguishable from kidnapping. If you've seen a video this year of, you know, guys in blue jeans and full face coverings picking people up off the sidewalk and throwing them into an unmarked van, in a lot of cases, those were ICE agents. So ICE has been around, as we said, since 2003, but it is growing. And the latest federal budget this year included just a massive funding increase for ICE that I think if you weren't following budget back and forth very closely, you might have missed this, but ICE got a $45 billion increase for immigration detention, as well as $29.9 billion with a B for the coming budget year that starts October 1st. And to put that in perspective, $29.9 billion is larger than the annual military budget of entire countries, including, for example, the Netherlands, Brazil, Algeria, Iran. So Homeland Security and ICE operate at the federal level, but we are seeing them in our streets and communities more and more often. And we know they're on a hiring blitz right now, so we expect to see more of that. But because we are a South Carolina podcast, I wanted to talk about some of the local collaboration, you know, the ways that our state and local law enforcement agencies are sometimes complicit. In what ways are we seeing that show up, Jace?
Yeah, the main way we're seeing collaboration between ICE and Homeland Security and local law enforcement is through what are known as 287G agreements. So ordinarily in the United States, immigration enforcement is the job of federal agencies. But under Section 287G of the Immigration and Nationality Act, ICE can train and authorize local law enforcement officers to identify, arrest, and detain people for potential deportation. So in the most expansive version of these agreements, that's known as the task force model, local law enforcement agencies make immigration arrests during routine police enforcement. So local police officers under these agreements are effectively turned into ICE agents. Now, these agreements used to be rare, in part because local police wanted no part in federal immigration enforcement. But this year, the number of 287G agreements in South Carolina has increased tenfold, from 3 to 30 and counting. Most recently, the South Carolina Department of Public Safety, and that's the folks who oversee our highway patrol, they announced they had applied for a 287G agreement. Now, that agreement is still pending as we record this episode, but it would dramatically change enforcement on our interstate highways, effectively signing up highway patrol officers to help Stephen Miller meet his arbitrary deportation quota.
You may be listening and wondering if your local police are part of this. So we do have a map on our website that is tracking the spread of 287G agreements across South Carolina. We'll put a link in the episode description today, but you can also go to aclusc.org/287G to check that out. Primarily, we're seeing this happen at the county level through sheriff's offices. So if you don't know already, that's a good way to find out if your sheriff has already signed on, and you can begin asking questions and applying pressure, because nothing is a done deal. Today on the podcast, we are going to talk to neighbors, faith leaders, activists, and immigrant rights activists about the damage ICE is doing around our state, the damage 287G agreements in particular are doing, and how people are showing up to push back. Up next, let's go back to the upstate. We have an interview with the Reverend Ramfis Moulier, who, along with other leaders in his area in Oconee County, has been trying to reason with the sheriff about 287G and about immigration enforcement and basic transparency. He hasn't given up yet, and neither have we.
I'm Ramfis Moulier, and I'm a ordained minister of an organization and the national bishop of an organization called Defenders of the Christian Faith Movement, also part of different local nonprofits, including a local church, and a national organization also called NALEC, which is the National Latinos Evangelical Council.
So we're going to talk a little bit about what happened at Puerto Nuevo in June, mm-hmm. but I want to back up some before that and talk about something that you and your church community and some of your neighbors, even beyond the church, tried to do in advance. You tried to have a conversation with the sheriff of Oconee County about immigration enforcement, ICE, 287G agreements. Start by, if you could, just telling me a little bit about that meeting that that you helped organize.
Well, yes, it actually took place because we, in the community, Hispanic coalition. There's a Hispanic coalition that is rising up from different community leaders, business owners, directors of different organizations, some community services that are focused on the Hispanic community. And we found out about the Oconee County Sheriff looking into the 287G. And if you remember the petition sent from the White House to the different sheriffs throughout the nation. So the first thing we actually did was visited the commission, the Oconee County Commission, and we spoke at a meeting and kind of shared with them some concerns about it. And to tell you the truth, I think we all walked away, and I should tell you, it was probably 95% supporters of the Hispanic community standing against the 287G, and for multiple reasons. And I think we all walked away pretty much ignored. Some of the issues that were brought up were discarded as, well, that's not necessarily true. That's not what's happening. That's not what the law is or the program is all about. So what we did was actually we called into the sheriff's office and told them that we had a number of Latino leaders that would come together and sit with him and talk to him and hear him out. Hear his heart. And so we called in for kind of like a private meeting, non-public meeting. And we did that with the intention of, hey, if we could clear the air, know exactly what you're standing, not only we could help the sheriff in making some decisions with the information that we have, but we could also turn around and help our community come down a little, because we were getting phone calls and people, as you can imagine, were worried all over the area, the county about it. And we said, you know, this could be a two-way. We could help you with some information, but we could also be your voice of calm in calmness in the community. And we had a meeting, and the sad part about the meeting was that most of us actually walked away from the meeting feeling really excited about the possibility of working together. In the meeting, we shared some experiences. One of the issues that a lot of the Anglo community, I think they miss, especially on the conservative side, that for us, immigration is way more than just numbers. It's we understand there is a problem with immigration in the U.S. that different laws need to be fixed. But for us, these are our families. These are family members, people that we live and love and spend time with. So yes, there were some emotions. Yes, there were moments of that we kind of had to pull back a little and control ourselves. But I would say 90% of the time that we spend there, we spend it listening to the sheriff, understanding. We were told that he wasn't sure about the 287G. I remember specifically, there was a question that somebody asked him and said, if this program, it's basically all about arresting people and deporting people and using the local resources just for that, and it wasn't necessarily focused on criminals, would you still support it? And we walked away hearing him out and convinced that he had said, no, we will not support it. And it will come against my convictions as a human, as a Christian, as a person, and as a community leader. So we walked away feeling, okay, there's hope. There's an opportunity for us to talk a little bit more. One of the things that also for me is a little disappointing was we walked away from that meeting agreeing that we were going to be establishing a smaller committee that from Hispanic leaders that would actually bring a lot more information to the sheriff in the process of making a decision. Unfortunately, we never heard back. We never heard anything about it, and it was never put together.
For those who aren't from your part of the state, give people a sense of the community there. I mean, is it? There are smaller towns. It's not. There aren't any huge metropolises. I mean, is this mm-hmm. a tight-knit community where you call a meeting like that and people kind of already know each other?
In a way. The community definitely runs as a small community, laid-back community. I lived in Minneapolis 31 years, grew up in Chicago, so this is not neither one of them. It's definitely a smaller town where life is a lot more relaxed. The only difference that specifically about knowing one another, the Hispanic community in Oconee County, it's pretty new. I've been here 2.5 years, and even when the moment that I got here, it's grown so much, and everybody's telling me it's started growing 4 or 5 years ago. So it's newer. We kind of know of each other. We've kind of crossed paths in the different restaurants and in the different meetings, events that are put together. So I would say a good 60% of the people there know each other. Or the rest of them know of each other, but yeah, it's a smaller community. It's almost impossible not to interact with other community leaders in everything that you do.
So, unlike the previous county council meeting, where you felt like you're probably mm-hmm. disregarded, you came away from this meeting feeling a little bit more like maybe the sheriff is listening. Maybe we have a good mm-hmm. start. To building some trust here. Did that turn out to be true?
Your description of how we walked away is definitely true. We truly left understanding that, or at least feeling that there was a desire to hear us out. And listen, we're not fools. We understand the political side. We understand the budgeting side. Where I think the commission and its chairman had been, if you know the fact that the chairman of the Oconee County Commission had posted on Facebook the fact that he wished he could build a wall around Wahala or Oconee County to keep Mexicans away, and so he doesn't turn into another Mexican city. So at that point, we understood there were some political figures involved, and that it would be hard for him to make a decision against it. But we were hopeful. What we heard was encouraging, and we felt heard. At that moment, we definitely thought we walked away feeling encouraged and thinking that there was going to be an open communication. Did it happen? Unfortunately, not. I would say it took us 3-4 weeks, even before the sheriff signed the agreement with the 287G. We understood that our perception was wrong. There seemed to be decisions made already, and that meeting was more to calm us down in terms of the goal of it. And I mean, within 3-4 weeks, I was getting phone calls of people already asking me, saying, "Hey, why do you call for this meeting again? What was the goal here?" I got to tell you, there were some people that even wonder if I and the other pastors or community leaders that put this together had anything to do with just quieting them down, because they were disappointed.
Do you remember how you found out about what happened at Puerto Nuevo?
As many community leaders did, we started getting texts. We started getting phone calls. I remember one specific, I want to say it was probably, I got a text. It was saying something happened in Puerto Nuevo, wasn't sure what, you know, you think right away about shootings and about something other illegally being done. So you're wondering what's going on. And then you start getting texts and all of a sudden you start getting videos. I think that was also a very disappointing moment. If because once again, you're thinking of the worst. It's like, oh, my God, is somebody shooting? Is it a fight? Is it what's going on? And then all of a sudden, you start getting videos of law enforcement being involved, I hope we all have seen the video of Juan, the Puerto Nuevo manager, part of the family who owns this place, being thrown against the floor, and you start seeing videos and how people are being treated. So. That's as you can imagine. I don't even know how many texts I got and how many phone calls I had to deal with and try to get answers. One of the things that I did right away, I went on Facebook and posted telling everybody, hey, apparently an immigration raid took place at Puerto Nuevo. Don't have a whole lot of information, but people just calm down. We're gonna get to the bottom of it and find out exactly what's happening. And I did it thinking there's some people that follow our account and read our post and it's going to be more of a community message. Within 30 minutes, I was bombarded by some people that even know me, criticizing me, coming after me and my convictions. Was I helping criminals? And so it was really confusing, like, okay, what's going on here? Because as far as I know, there was some immigration issues, but I don't have the whole information. But you seem to have all the information because you're speaking about criminals, and then they start talking about the kidnapping and sex trafficking and human trafficking, and it's like, okay, wait, where is all of this coming from, and how can we get to the bottom of it? So yeah, it was a very confusing moment, and via text, via phone calls, and even on social media, following and trying to see what was going on.
How would you describe?
Let me add this. One of the things that a couple of community leaders did was actually we communicated with the sheriff's office right away and asked him for some kind of response to, hey, I remember my text went something like, hey, I this is not an official request. I'm not necessarily going to share anything that you tell me. I just want to be able to know what's going on so I could answer to my people what's happening. And the response I got was actually 45 minutes or so after on my second text that I got some response from the office telling me it was a human trafficking warrant. And that was it. And then I got a phone call from a community leader saying that the sheriff's office had called them and told them to tell me what it was and that it was just a human trafficking a warrant. And that's all that they had because they were not involved in it. So that was all we heard.
Did you ever get any more clarity about what happened that day? I mean, after talking to people, figuring out, who was actually arrested, what charges there were, does it make any more sense?
I wish I could say yes, we communicated, we sat down, we talked, and did we get clarity? Some way, but not from the law enforcement. We're totally the opposite, but we got it from witnesses. We got it from, like I said, watching videos, interviewing some people. What we would love is tell us exactly what happened here, because I know the Leon family. I know the family that owns this place, and I've, like I said, I've gotten to even talk to a lot of them, especially Juan, the manager, who anybody in our community will be extremely proud of this young man. But let's be real. If there is human trafficking, if there's truly human trafficking, if there is anything that they're doing to take advantage of other Hispanics, put him in jail. Arrest them. But that's not what they did.
Right. To this day, there have been no arrests related to human trafficking there. It
At
was
all.
they were there were some arrests related to immigration charges, but yeah, for all the talk about human trafficking, still no charges. So something doesn't add up.
And there is no information. You see what I mean? Because if they were to tell us, listen, here's the investigation, here's what's happening, here's what got us there. I at least would have no problem in backing down and saying, man, hey, you do what you have to do. You're here to protect us. But when I think the word, I don't remember the number specifically because we continue to get different numbers, but seven to eight people arrested primarily for immigration. So it's really hard not to call it an immigration raid because they were arrested for immigration, and the only two people that were arrested for anything but that was actually disorderly conduct because the police actually claimed that they interfered with whatever what was happening. One of them being the manager of the place, and all he was doing, and you can tell by the videos, was asking for the warrant. Where are the documents? Because at that moment, no documents have been provided.
Right. And that's something we tell people in Know Your Rights trainings all the time. When law enforcement shows up, especially at your place of business, you can and should ask to see a signed judicial warrant, a warrant signed by a judge. I
And
guess
that's basic rights. This is not only affected people with illegal immigration status, but a U.S. citizen was thrown against the floor, arrested, and went to jail because of the actions of what took place there. So it will continue to affect U.S. citizen. I don't even want to know how it has affected the economy in this area. The most people should know by now that I think it was 85 or 90% of the Hispanic restaurants were closed down. For a while, some of them a couple of weeks before they opened up again. The Hispanic community, I mean, one of the things that I remember 2 days after I went to Walmart where I usually see a bunch of Hispanics, and there were hardly two, I probably saw three or four families there. So even the big stores were being affected by the fact that the Hispanics are concerned about what's happening. And this includes US citizens, because if I'm a US citizen, but my father, my grandfather, my uncle is not, I don't want to be driving around him with him because I don't want to carry the responsibility of being stopped just because we look different or because somebody believed we might be undocumented and then him being deported.
One last question, and I'll let you go. What happens next? You tried to reach out and build some understanding early on. You felt like maybe that you were not actually listened to. But do you have a plan going forward, or how do you want to go about creating or rebuilding some trust?
And Paul, as ridiculous as it may sound, I'm still hopeful. I'm still hopeful. I truly believe one of the things that I love about Oconee County when I got here 2.5 years ago is I was coming from the north to deal with Southerners. And the reputation on the North is that Southerners are not very welcoming people to people in my community. And it's been totally the opposite. I mean, every moment I've lived here, I have so many people that embraced us and loved us, and that I have an accent. You could hear my accent. And I've spoken in Anglo churches locally, and I'm invited, and they welcome me. I spend time. I got friends, people that I love, that I've gotten to love in 2.5 years, that knew nothing about my community, and there are Anglos from South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee. So I'm still hopeful.
Hi, Paul. My name is Dulce Lopez. I am the immigrant rights advocacy strategist for the ACLU of South Carolina.
Dulce, I'm really glad I get to work with you, and I'm really glad you came on the podcast today to share some of what you've learned and share some of your expertise. So we just got done hearing from Ramfis Moulier, a pastor in the upstate who you connected me with. And he spoke about this enforcement action, this raid that the police don't want to call a raid at the Puerto Nuevo restaurant in West Union, South Carolina. He tried to get some facts and learn the truth of the matter from the sheriff, who he thought he had a good enough working relationship with, but he really got frustrated. He didn't really get very clear answers on what actually happened that day. So that's where you come in. I know you spent some time in West Union talking to people, eyewitnesses, people in the community. Tell me about your time up there and what you learned.
Thank you, Paul, for putting this together. And also for working with me. I think that this work is super important, and it's magnificent that I get to work with you. So on June 18th, you gave already the summary of what happened. But what was not said in the news was how the community lived this raid. A raid that officially was not called a raid. It was called a law enforcement operation for human trafficking. So during this incident, 10 individuals were arrested, and these were workers, members of the community, people that, were contributing in one way or another to the economy of Oconee County. And the reason why the community was so concerned about this raid was because out of these 10 people arrested, supposedly it was a human trafficking investigation, and we most definitely want human trafficking victims to get the help that they need, the resources that they need. The concern that we have is that eyewitness account reported that the 10 individuals arrested were handcuffed as they were taken out. They were workers inside. They were the cooks, the waiters, a manager even, like trying to get clarification of what was going on. It was all confusion. It was chaos. And they were taken out in handcuffs, even those that were allegedly human trafficking victims. So that's where the concern comes. People didn't know what was going on. Everyone knew that Oconee County was entering a 287G agreement. So how does this play into the operation? People were concerned, is this law enforcement cooperating with ICE? Is this going to be a norm in our community? Many of the businesses closed that day and the day after, the Hispanic businesses, because they didn't know if they were going to be the next target amid the confusion of what was going on. So the public was calling for transparency as far as this operation. Who were the people arrested? What were the charges that they were imposed with? What type of resources were the people identified as victims of human trafficking receiving? What were the protocols that were used to arrest people? Because according to the public records, there was no one who was arrested on human trafficking charges. The people arrested were arrested on charges of entering the country illegally. So that places a huge burden on the community to try and find out clear and transparent information from the officials, the city officials. So that's essentially all of the confusion that was lived throughout Oconee County.
You mentioned the 287G agreement, which was new this year in Oconee County. Sheriff Mike Crenshaw entered it, and they were pretty defensive about this. After these arrests, the sheriff's office put out a statement and said, "The agreement signed by the Oconee County Sheriff's Office in March in reference to the warrant service officer's model of 287G is not connected in any way to the current federal labor trafficking investigation." There was a real, I would say, cloud of suspicion because of that. I mean, people were genuinely worried about this collaboration and what it would mean. I mean, can you speak to the effect of an agreement like that on public trust in law enforcement?
Yes, definitely. I think that already the trust with law enforcement was very thin. However, the sheriff's decision to sign on to this agreement completely eroded that trust between the community and law enforcement. And this comes as a result of the lack of transparency, again, from public officials. So in February of 2025, they had a public meeting, a county council meeting, and 23 out of 25 speakers opposed 287G agreement. It was understood that the sheriff was not going to move forward, or if he did, he was going to put it up to a public vote. However, he moved forward with this via an internal vote. And I think this struck the community as a treason almost. They felt that their voices weren't heard, that this decision wasn't justified because they had had a meeting prior to 287G being signed on in this county. And in this meeting, it was told to them that their concerns were going to be listened, but at the end of the day, their concerns were not listened to.
So you helped write this joint statement on July 8th that we signed along with a lot of local advocacy organizations from around Oconee County, just demanding better transparency about this specific issue at Puerto Nuevo, but also a withdrawal from 287G. Since then, have we really learned anything new? Has the sheriff's office or DHS or ICE opened up any more about what really happened that day?
It's my understanding that DHS made a statement officially about the raid, but they didn't really give any information. It wasn't clear to the community what happened. And I think that cloud of suspicion is still there from the community as far as what is it that we get from public officials as far as information goes, at least. And the fact of the matter is that the community no longer trusts law enforcement. And this is regardless of what happened at Puerto Nuevo. Now the situation is 287G. How is this going to impact regular community members who are driving their kids to school, community members who are driving their kids to their dentist appointment, who are on their way to work? Now their way of life is being threatened by this agreement, by the 287G agreement. These are people that have lived there, who have raised their kids there, who work there and contribute in taxes. So now they're scared about this agreement essentially separating them from their families.
Stay tuned for more of this conversation with Dulce on episode 16 of While I Breathe. In this next episode, we'll continue unpacking what really happened at other immigration raids around the state, including the infamous June 1st raid in Ladson. And we'll also travel to Beaufort County, where hundreds of locals have shown up to oppose a 287G agreement signed by their sheriff. This isn't over.
Thank you for listening to another episode of While I Breathe. If you want to take action after what you've heard today, there is a lot of work for you to do. If you would like to sign a petition against the ICE detention camp being proposed by candidates running for governor here in South Carolina, go to aclusc.org/ICE25. We have about 13,000 signatures in counting. And if you sign that petition, that makes sure that we can be in touch with you about follow-up actions you can take if and when the specific plans for that facility do become public. If you would like to volunteer with the ACLU of South Carolina, we have a quick interest form you can fill out at aclusc.org/volunteer. There, you can select which issues matter most to you, including immigrant rights, voting rights, and reproductive rights, and then we'll be in touch to let you know how you can get involved.
I just want to emphasize again, remember 287G. If there's anything you take away from this, I want to make 287G agreements famous. People should know where these agreements are in effect. And this is a real place where we can actually push back at the local level. You in your community with your neighbors can make 287G agreements an issue in local politics and local elections. So, you know, find out when the next sheriff's race is and start asking the candidates for their stances, get them on the record about it. So that, you know, these are often agreements that local sheriffs and sometimes police chiefs will enter, but also, you know, consider where the power lies. You know, in the case of sheriffs, often it's the county council where you live that controls funding. Speak out at county council meetings. I think sometimes when we talk about federal policy, it can seem so beyond our control, but we still have power locally in our communities. Another way you can help out is by volunteering with one of the ICE tip lines being created all over the state right now. So as you've probably seen by now, rumors of immigration raids sometimes spread online, and sometimes they are real and sometimes they are not. But when false rumors spread, it can cause panic and fear. And so networks of volunteers are forming across the state right now to verify reports of immigration enforcement actions and alert our communities. As a reminder, it is your right to record law enforcement agents in public spaces, and these groups can help you go about that safely and responsibly in a way that serves your community. I'll have links where you can sign up to help with a few of these local hotlines in the episode description. Music on our podcast today is by Daft Hartley and A Spot on the Hill. And as always, if you got something out of today's episode, just please tell your friends about the podcast and maybe leave a nice review. We depend on word of mouth to publicize this podcast, and we know that we have brilliant, well-connected people listening right now who can help.
And until next time, while I breathe,